The Open Door of Emptiness. Chapter 2. Love and Impermanence. Part 1. Generally speaking, in Western culture, we believe in love. And we even believe that another human being can save us. Only you. You're the one. When I am with you, I feel whole, for a while. It's a common feeling. Without you, I'm nothing. You fill me up. There are many love songs with words like that. This raises the important question, who am I? What is the lack in me which I seek to fill by finding you? Who are you? And how do I imagine you to be? What qualities do you have? We have ideas about ourselves and ideas about the other. One of the functions of meditation is to bring us close to the actuality of what is manifesting so that, in experiencing phenomena as they are, we can see if our idea about a phenomenon actually brings us close to how things are. Usually, we find that if we have the name for something and can describe it, then this brings us close to what is there. Actually, it brings us close to our idea of what is there, but not to any reality. We live in a jungle of concepts, which do provide illumination of a kind, but the clarification is established inside our belief that the concepts we hold speak about how things are. When we start to meditate, we become aware that our mind is full of thought. We find ourselves caught up in an ongoing commentary about experience, judging, developing opinion, reinforcing our assumptions. The better we notice this, the better we see that our view of the world is mediated through, or veiled by, this network of interpreted concepts. It's not that concepts are wrong or bad, it's about applying them in the right place. For example, unless you are a rock star, you probably won't wear sunglasses indoors. If you wear your concepts all of the time, your view of the world might be a bit tinted, which means that your relationship to other people will be a bit tinted. Tibetan Buddhism has many styles of practice. They are referred to as vehicles, or ways of travelling to the goal of awakening. Each is organised into view, meditation, behaviour, and result. One meditation, from the first vehicle, is saying, I'm wandering in confusion. Whenever I sit to meditate, I notice that I easily get distracted. I'm all over the place, and so I have to learn to control my mind. That view is linked to making decisions about behaviour, such as avoiding stimulating circumstances. The aim is to be calm so that I can develop my potential. In some ways, it's a path of mastery. The assumption is that if I get rid of all my limitations and develop my full potential, then I can become like the Buddha. It's all up to me, and if it doesn't go well, then there's no one else I can blame. To follow that kind of Dharma path, you have to develop very broad, strong shoulders, because you have to carry everything yourself. There are 9 different vehicles, and here I will be focusing on Dzogchen, the 9th vehicle. Dzogchen means the whole, or the great completion. When we sit and meditate, we soon notice that our mind is moving. My self then decides that I don't want my mind to move by itself, since, after all, I am the boss of my mind. If my hand were to suddenly jump up and grab my ear, I would get quite upset. My hand should behave itself. So, whenever we begin our practice from the position of the ego, we are in an ongoing struggle to get ourselves back on track. The Dzogchen view is not to jump into judgment. We simply observe. Lots of things are moving in the mind. Hopes, fears, memories, sensations, and so on. Things arise and pass. They're there for a while, and then they're gone. There are many things in my mind, and they're all moving in all different directions. It's going to take a lot of energy to try to control them. What happens if I don't control them? I get angry for a while. I get jealous for a while. I'm sweet and friendly for a while. My moods are not predictable and reliable. So why should I expect other people to be reliable? The mind is not an animal to be tamed. In some of the Buddha's teachings, the mind is described as an elephant or a buffalo, and it gradually comes under our control. But when we observe what is experienced, there are experiences outside and sensations inside. This movement doesn't come to an end. That is just how it is. So movement is not seen as the enemy, not seen as something to be constrained and controlled. When you start with an idea of how you should be or could be, then this idea or image becomes the point with which you try to align yourself. Dictatorships often have public artworks of paintings or sculptures of good citizens and good workers. That's because structures of dominance always have a template. Whether the template is in religion or in politics or your own individual idea, then fitting the template is decisive. If you fit the template, you are good. If you don't fit the template, you are bad. From the point of view of Dzogchen, this kind of framework is stupid, blind, blunt, and cruel. It's blind because it doesn't invite you to see. It advises you to see what you're told to see. This is what the Buddha is like, and if you want to be like the Buddha, you have to become like that. How do you get there? Who is it who is trying to get there? Don't worry about that. Just try to get there. You don't know who you are. You don't know how you are. But you do know you should be somewhere. This is called fascism. Let's not do that. Our interest is to be present with ourselves and let the actuality of existence reveal itself, however it is. The more you start with an image of how it should be, the more you are introducing a prejudice, a predisposition, which means you're trying to become something. So how can we see in the most simple, neutral way? If you notice there's a lot going on in your mind when you practice, you might have the thought that your mind is very disturbed. You can have that sentence with or without mustard. If you apply the mustard, My mind is very disturbed. That's clearly wrong. It shouldn't happen. Then I want to scrape off the mustard. Am I disturbed by my disturbed mind? Well, yes. Sometimes I'm happy and sometimes I'm sad. When I'm happy, I'm happy. And when I'm sad, I'm sad. I am unreliable, unpredictable, inconsistent, and yet, if I am sad, when I am sad, what else should I be? What's wrong with being sad for a while? I taste happy. I taste sad. Different tastes. But both are tastes. Like the colours on an artist's palette, a wide range is available. If you were an artist and painted with only one of the colours on your palette, you might sell your paintings for a few years. But after a while, people would ask you to extend your range, to vary your colours. We might be happy for others to see some of the colours which arise for us as us. Other colours we'd like to keep hidden. We don't want people to know that our colour is envy or jealousy or failure, because it makes us feel bad, and we don't want to feel bad. It's this judgment, any judgment about our situation, blinds us to the actuality of our feeling. With this blindness, our tendencies are to merge into the feeling and collapse into misery, or to recoil and struggle to separate from it, take some medication, or do some sports to try to shift the medical balance. In meditation texts, these two positions are described again and again. Don't merge into what is arising, and don't shift away from it. Just be present with it. Whatever is arising is the flavour or the colour that is filling your life at this moment. It's not always going to be like that, since all phenomena are impermanent. They arise and pass. If you merge into an arising feeling, it becomes the totality of your experience, and it feels as if this will go on forever. We believe it is true and real, or it is true and real, so there's nothing to be done. But these conclusions are the result of taking transient patternings of experience, called illusion in Buddhism, and acting towards them as if they told eternal truths. In the meditation practice, our main focus is to stay present with whatever is arising, while avoiding these two extremes of merging or enforced separation. We will see that our experience is ever-changing, that life is dynamic. When a baby is born, it's given a name. People come to see it and are told that this is Magda. They may be shown lots of photos of Magda. Look at what Magda can do now. Look how Magda lifts a spoon. Look at Magda taking her first step. Magda exists. Does Magda exist in Magda? The mother sees Magda, but who is there? The baby is not intrinsically Magda. It's not produced in a factory with the name of the product stamped on the forehead. The name is a convention. We happen to call this child Magda, but it could have been called many other names. Due to causes and conditions, maybe a saint's day or some family tradition, It was named Magda. And when we say that name, we know who we mean. She is Magda. We refer to her with that name. Someone is there. First a non-walking Magda, then a walking Magda, then a walking and talking Magda. Is walking and talking Magda the same as non-walking Magda? The face of a baby at 3 months and at 3 years is very different. The sensory and motor skills are changing. The expressive range of emotions is changing. The use of language is developing. Is this the same person? Yes. How do we know? Because it's Magda. The truth of Magda is the name. The most enduring factor in Magda's life is the name. Since you've been born, you've been thousands of people, but generally, the name continues. The name is abstract, conventional, assigned, a signifier. Is a signifier what it signifies? No. When we say Magda and we look at the girl, are we describing this form, this phenomenon? Or are we describing our idea about Magda? No, Magda, don't behave like that. Be the proper little Magda that I know, so I can love you. Because if you're your own Magda, then you're becoming a delinquent Magda. And you know how long the waiting list is for child therapy. So please conform, fit in. Be the Magda that I love, and that I know you really are. Magda is an idea, just as myself is an idea. Each of us exists in two different planes. The first is the unfolding of our potential moment by moment in conversation with circumstances. How we manifest, how we show ourselves, depends on who we're talking to and where we are. If you were in a Catholic church, you would not sit on the floor. But if you were in a Buddhist temple, you would sit yourself on the floor. It's a situational thing. Your body takes on this particular position according to the idea of where you are. When you're not being a Buddhist, you won't be sitting on the floor. You have a mental frame and an environmental frame. And as these arise, you find yourself sitting on a cushion on the floor. As you enter a room, you look around and see where other people are sitting. Your relation with the field of experience reins your body into a particular position. You are co-emergent with the environment. The important point here is to see the fantasy of individual agency, that I am living life on my terms. Each of us is here for all kind of reasons. We're doing the activity of being here together according to the co-arising of circumstances. I am here talking with you about Buddhism because I've been involved in this for many years. There is no inherent Buddhism in me. I've just been swimming in the ocean of Buddhism or Dharma for a long time. So what I can share with you is streaming pathways that arise through me while I am with you. There is not a box inside me, labelled Buddhist James, which I keep closed when I go to the supermarket. I don't need to be Buddhist James to buy potatoes. I need to be James with some money in my pocket to buy potatoes. But if I'm going to be here talking with you, I need to be Buddhist James. Is that a particular identity inside me? Or does it arise through me being here with you? What is arising is something which belongs to all of us. It's the truth of the field. In Buddhism, this is called dependent co-origination. On the basis of this, that arises. On the basis of me studying Tibetan and so on, certain things can arise in this life stream, which I manifest at the moment. After some time, as I get older, I probably won't do this in the same way, or as much. Due to the fact of not being dead yet, I am here. I will be dead. When? I don't know. How amazing. We don't know when we're going to die. How can we plan for our life if we don't know when we're going to die? We have no idea of the shape of our existence. We don't know what thought is going to arise in our mind in the next moment. We don't know what sensation is going to arise in our body. We know a lot of things, but we don't know much. The important things, we don't know. The reason we don't know them is because they are unknowable. I am a stream of experience, yet I imagine that there is a continuity to I, me, myself. As far as I can remember, I have always been me. That is a sentence we can all say. It seems a meaningful thing to say. It seems to be obviously true. I am me and not you. I've always been me. I was not you yesterday and me today. You have always been you, as far as I know. But I definitely have always been me. However, when I look for the ingredients of me, my beliefs, they've changed a bit. My memories, they've changed a lot. My plans, always changing. My thoughts, feelings, sensations, always changing. We're also relational in our value. My Buddhist knowledge can be of some use now to you, but when I apply for a job, it won't be important to an employer. We believe that this is important. Whether it is important or not is simply our mental activity. We can stay immersed inside our dream time, but we have the chance to become curious. Who is the dreamer? Who is the one that believes that I am me? So we have the content of our mind, memories, plans, everything we know, arising and shifting in endless permutation, and yet we are aware of something occurring. The continuity of this clarity about being alive seems to be generated by the content of our mind. Am I present because I myself is the one that is present? Or is presence an illuminating quality which shows me being here? These are not philosophical questions. These are ontological questions about the nature of our being. And this is the most intimate sense of ourselves we can have. Can I believe the content of my mind when I tell myself a reassuring story about my existence? Am I enlivening the feeling tone of my life? Or am I singing a lullaby, putting myself to sleep? We want to look at the fixed sense that we have of ourselves and of the people we love and get involved with. Can love be eased out of attachment towards a more open appreciation? Very often, if we appreciate something, we want to get it. You're special, so I want you with me. If I add you onto my life, I'm going to improve. But that only works if I see the other as an apprehendable object, because I can think of myself as an apprehendable object. Can we have the clarity, which is non-conceptual, so that instead of simply building up images and storylines of who we are, we can, with direct, fresh presence, experience the illumination of what we take to be ourselves and others. Teaching given in Warsaw over the 14th to 15th of December 2019. Edited by Barbara Terrace and James Lowe. From the book The Open Door of Emptiness by James Lowe. Read by Wendy, February 2025.